And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, so much to get to, so much to talk about. The Corbett budget that everyone seems to agree is nothing more than a campaign year budget. It's campaign year pandering is what it is. And look, I'm amazed, honestly, that even the right wing here in Pennsylvania is going, oh, I can't do this. It's campaign year pandering. Well, what did you expect? I'm also going to talk about the ALEC anti-worker HB 1507, the House bill put forth by our good Republican friend Seth Grove and Daryl Mad Cow Metcalf, you know, because nothing says family values like sticking it to workers, right? Right? Absolutely. Also going to talk about how do we defend good-paying American jobs? How do we defend it against the corporate attacks and this race to the bottom? Also, the nation's infrastructure desperately in need of investment. What would that look like? What do we need to do? How much do we need? And can we afford it? I know we hear a lot. Oh, but Rick, we're broke. We don't have any money. There's nothing here. Sorry. Well, the lights are about to be turned off. They're coming. They're taking the furniture. It's over. Ridiculous. There's money to be there. If we had the will. And I look at the governor's campaign year pandering budget with a lot of its one time, hey, we found money here. Got our hand in the sofa cushions. Comes down to priorities. Comes down to political will. It comes down to pressure. It comes down to you and me and all the rest of us saying, you know, we're not putting up with nonsense. I found over the weekend very interesting. They're pushing more P3s, and we're going to talk about the public-private partnership that I've been telling you is coming for a couple of years now. I've been saying, look, this is on the docket in 2012. They passed the mother of P3 pieces of legislation. They're going full steam with it. We'll talk about that. Also, I guess the NFL is going to have the very first openly gay player. The question is, do you care? I don't. But, you know, some do, and there's been an awful lot of ridiculousness around it. But we'll talk about that also. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So over the weekend, and this is amazing, you know, and the South right now is a hotbed of organizing. The South right now is a hotbed of activism. The South right now is the place where people have said, you know what? We have been getting dumped on for generations now. We've seen corporations come from the North to the South, exploit the workforce, exploit the resources, and then once they've destroyed the working conditions, the wages, the hours, all that stuff of the workers in the North, then they saw Mexico and China and other places as places where they could go and move jobs to destroy wages even worse in the South. Now you're seeing people saying enough already. You're seeing people standing up to the political right-wingism, if you will, the insanity. And I look over the weekend in North Carolina, the moral march on Raleigh, which, you know, depends on which news source you look to. Now, there have been some estimates, you know, Fox News, I'm sure, would say, well, there were 80 people that showed up, and, well, you know, or they sent the guy to the wrong address like they did the last time. So nobody's here. We're all by ourselves. Estimates were somewhere between 80 and 100,000 people in the streets in Raleigh, North Carolina, talking about, hey, you know what? Against the idea of cutting education, against the idea of what you've done to the unemployment compensation, against the idea of taking away women's rights, voter rights, all of the right-wing ALEC-type attacks that have been going on for the last couple of years that have gone on in North Carolina, the people of that state have said enough already. And you had upwards of 100,000 people in the streets there. And I've been saying for the longest time, for those who are longtime listeners, I've been saying this for years. The only time things change is when those who are sitting at the top worry that their heads could end up on sticks. It's that simple. The people who are sitting at the top, when they are the ones who will be toppled, when they are the ones who are going to pay the consequences, that's when things change. And, you know, as we did our labor history tour over the summer, we went to places where you heard stories of, you know, during the Depression, there were 100,000 people in this square here. There were 50,000 people here in line waiting for bread to feed their family. There were thousands of people here, and they were tearing this country apart brick by brick, demanding that their government do something, that their government provide jobs, that their government provide food, help make life tolerable. So when you see these kind of people, these numbers of folks out in the streets in a place like Raleigh, North Carolina, you got to wonder what's going to happen here in Pennsylvania when the insanity that Alec brought, because, hey, we had voter suppression, everybody kind of took it in stride. Hey, we had the attacks on the unemployment, everybody kind of took it in stride. What's going to happen when the anti-worker stuff starts? Are we the next Wisconsin? Are you going to see 100,000 people in our capital? I think when that happens, then you see things change. And for me, you know, as we're seeing this organizing going on, and we're seeing tons of organizing in the South, and a little bit later in the program, I'm going to talk about what's going on down at Volkswagen. An amazing, amazing story. And Volkswagen, they better watch out. They're going to lose their corporate citizen card. Oh, they're going to lose their corporate card. They're not going to be allowed to come to the meetings anymore and have the secret handshake. No more for Volkswagen. But I look at this and I go, you know, all of these people in the streets, Moral Mondays, and all of this organizing that's going on around the country, talking about, you know, what's the future going to look like? And over the weekend, I sat down with my daughter, and, you know, we have these conversations every once in a while. Something pops up, and maybe it's just, you know, me, I like to lecture. I don't know. But we were having this conversation about her future because, you know, she was sitting in the driver's seat of my car, and she goes, I can't wait to drive, because she's 11 going on 12 and is already getting that I want to drive a car kind of thing. And she goes, I want to have a stick shift just like you. And I go, well, stick shifts, by the time you're 16, will have been ancient history. They're almost ancient history now. You can't get a decent truck in this country anymore with a stick shift than that I found. In fact, most of the semis, I guess, built are automatics, which I hate. But I digress. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, what her future is going to look like. And, I'm of the mindset, and, you know, I told her, I said, look, chances are you're probably going to be the last generation to actually learn how to drive a car. Your children will probably never need to drive a car, because I mean, you look at this Google car that's got 2 million miles on it already of incident-free driving without a driver. Eventually, that's where it's going. And you look at the Department of Transportation, who just last week said, hey, all cars are going to have to communicate with each other so that we can cut down on they're claiming 80% of all accidents. I look at it, you know, a little differently as well. It's going to be a nice revenue stream once they get that technology in place. But, you know, hey, the technology's there. It's going to happen because humans are fallible. And, you know, like I told my daughter, you know, at some point that's going to happen. And, you know, look, you know, the jobs that are here today aren't going to be there tomorrow. In 20 years, half of the jobs that are being done right now, they're going to disappear. They're going to be mechanized. They're going to be done by robots. They're going to be done by software. It is what it is. It's the world that she's going to inherit. And it's while it's scary on one hand, there's opportunity on the other. And as we were talking, I said, your generation is going to be the greatest generation. And I believe that. If you've read the book, The Fourth Turning, and you look at how things have moved itself out, her generation is supposed to be my grandparents, my great-grandparents' generation, my great-grandparents and that grandparent era, you know, the World War II generation. Every 100 years you have this turning, and every 80 to 100 years. So I think she's going to be in that era of the greatest generation, the ones that are going to decide what the future is really going to look like. Because my generation is just holding on to the destruction. What's the future going to look like when half of the jobs that are here now are gone? What's it going to look like to have a family? What's the middle class? Is there going to be a middle class? Is there going to be a nuclear family? What's it going to look like? And her generation is going to decide this stuff. You know, I mean, you go back to the Industrial Revolution. They were dealing with a lot of the same things, moving from an agricultural nation into an industrial nation, into big booming cities. And what did that mean for the workers? What did that mean for the workers going into the industrial plants? What did it mean for the workers who were working on the farms. And today we're going through that same kind of process. We're going from an industrial nation, even though they keep saying we're going to bring manufacturing back. Yeah, it'll be done mostly with computers and mostly with robotics and all of that stuff. We're not going back to, and I know some people like to think we're going to go back to making steel the way they did in the 50s and 60s with 100,000 people. Somebody told me the other day that we actually put out as much steel as we did back in the country's heyday with like 1/100th of the workforce. And that number is shrinking. So those days that, you know, we're going to have 100,000 people working in the steel, it's not going to happen again. So the question then becomes, what does the future look like? And I was, you know, my daughter and I were talking, I was saying, you know, what has to happen is we have to start thinking about how we have consumers, how we have people who can survive and raise families and have a society that's still functional and an income distribution that's spread a little bit better so that you don't have wide swaths of poverty and really narrow numbers of wealthy. What you need to be able to figure out is how do we make sure that people have a minimum standard of living? And for me, it comes back down to this idea, and I go back to the very conservative Milton Friedman, this idea that we have a negative tax or something of a, you know, a guaranteed income or something along the lines so that everybody has at least some ability to survive. Because, look, technology is here to stay. The reality is what it is. Labor unions are under massive attacks. The idea is that employers are willing to keep unions around because you had industrial peace. You'd give the workers a little bit of something that would quiet them down for a little while, and they would do all the work that you wanted, and they would do it well and with lots of productivity, and you'd be able to pocket those productivity gains. Every couple of years, you'd have to share a little bit, but not all of it, a little bit. And there was industrial peace. Well, now what's going on is employers, they don't want that industrial peace. They don't care. They've got total, complete, and absolute control. So when they have all of these productivity gains, hey, it's more profit for us. And what we end up with is we end up with a part-time workforce. We end up with consultant workforce, contract labor, you know. We end up with, you know, these ideas that, well, you know, we need to be more flexible, which generally means we need younger workers. And I look at this and go, what happens? And, you know, the other part of it is, you know, I go to this restaurant all the time. And I go a lot to where they all know me. And I order the same thing, so they all know what I order. And they have this little screen that I'm supposed to order my drinks on or my appetizers or whatever on that I refuse to use. Absolutely, without question, refuse to use it. And it's because they're in the process of doing away with my waitress. And I won't pay my bill on the thing either because they're going to do away with my waitress. That's going to happen. And it's interesting to me that, because look, I understand making the waitress's job easier. And these machines do make their jobs easier. Problem is, it's going to do away with it. It's going to make it so easy that they don't have a job. And that's where my concern is. And maybe I'm the only one who's fighting this uphill battle. Maybe I'm the only one that thinks about this. But it is something worth talking about and worth really spending a little time thinking about. So I'm going to go through some of this today because this has been on my mind for a while. It's been one of those things that's been kind of there. So if you've got any thoughts, any questions, any comments, any ideas, I'd love to hear them. You can always email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Pat Harkin, Harkin's about the Corbett budget and the attack on workers as well. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top. History. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science, folk. Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Progressive South is on the march. An estimated 80,000 people created a powerful moral march on Raleigh over the weekend in North Carolina. Organized by the NAACP and combined with an annual historic Thousands on Jones Street, or HK on J March, this one is powered by the Moral Monday's Forward Together movement. That movement seeks to end poverty, strengthen labor rights, ensure voter rights, sustain a strong public education system, and environmental protections. Here's some of what the Moral March on Raleigh sounded like.
No matter how much workers sacrifice, it never seems to be enough. This legislature cut unemployment benefits for folks who were out of jobs. They want to deny Medicaid to people who are struggling. So even when people are down, they still want to kick people to the curb.
I think this is a tremendous demonstration and show of how ready people are for change in the politics and the tone of life in North Carolina right now.
North Carolina is clearly under assault in many different realms. Education is one of them, voting rights, access to health care. And the beauty of what's going on right now is that I think for my students, it's the first time that policies that are made in Raleigh have a direct and measurable impact on their lives.
The Moral Monday's Forward Together movement protests triggered 1,000 civil disobedience arrests last year as the movement resists what it says is a destructive right-wing agenda. The movement unites civil rights, the labor movement, voting rights movements, LGBT rights with women's rights against the right-wing political agenda in North Carolina. North Carolina NAACP president and Moral Monday's organizer, the Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are natives and immigrants. We are business leaders and workers and unemployed. We are doctors and the uninsured. We are gay. We are straight. We are students. We are parents. We are retirees. We are North Carolina. We are America. And we are here. And we ain't going nowhere.
North Carolina Republican Party Chairman Claude Pope calls the Moral Monday movement radical left-wing activism. He says the movement wants to eviscerate state Republican leaders. The American Federation of Government Employees is holding its legislative conference in Washington, D.C. this week. 1,000 members and union activists from across the country are attending. Members of Congress are speaking. The conference runs through Wednesday. The AFGE says there will be a shared prosperity rally, a Bureau of Prisons candlelight vigil, and a picket for TSA officers. The conference is used to plan AFGE's legislative agenda for the coming year.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need a budget that employs simple honesty for the common growth of our commonwealth. We must continue the journey that will turn the road to recovery into the path to prosperity.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So I look at Ted Pope. He is a congressman from Tennessee. Good Republican congressman from Tennessee. Hopes the GOP takes the Senate here in November. He was speaking at the Heritage Foundation today and had a great quote. He said, I would suggest we nominate people. When we nominate people, we give them a roll of duct tape to put over their mouths so they don't say stupid things, and maybe we can win an election. And I look at our governor, a lot of stupid things coming out of his mouth, like the entire budget, in my view. A lot of this stuff, it's campaign electioneering, but, and even his own party. Now, it's interesting, you know, he has cited in his, this Ted Poe, cited in his speech, Representative Tom Cotton, the Republican from Arkansas, who evidently claimed that women are to blame for divorce. He's one of those guys that he's supporting. Not quite the duct tape. Also, Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, who said that the health care law's birth control mandate was an assault on religious freedom. And they're the best the GOP has. Oh. Can you imagine what the Senate looks like? Maybe it looks like the extreme part of the Republican Senate here in Pennsylvania, which is why I'm hoping November turns things around. Anyway, to find out what's going on with the budget, the talks are ongoing. Things are beginning to heat up. That's why we've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Pat Harkins to come talk with us. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Great. It's great to be with you tonight.
So I look at this budget, and you know, there doesn't seem to be anybody who's overly thrilled with it. Even the right is saying, how do you pay for it? Even they're saying there's some gimmicks.
After the budget was, after Corbett gave his presentation, I was walking out of the chamber, and I spoke with a couple of sensible Republicans who pretty much just shook their head, and they said, this guy spent how much money to a Bush speechwriter, and he didn't get his money's worth as far as what we could see.
And that's what they got.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, when you look at the priorities that were laid out in the budget, were we really surprised? There was some lip service paid to education, but still a lot of tax breaks for businesses. Nothing really substantial in investing for the future. A lot of talk about, hey, we're going to push this healthy PAs thing, but it's not going to happen. A lot of rhetoric.
Yeah, no, from the Medicaid expansion, which I don't think the federal government will go for in the end, to education, which I think is smoke and mirrors, block grants that aren't going to do anybody very much. And then you look at the special ed funding formula. Under Rendell, that was on the right path to get us where we needed to be with that. But what I really was let down in and disappointed in was nothing of substance as far as job creation. I figured that being an election year, he might be smart enough or have people around him with some smarts that would say, put people back to work and he's going to put a lot of fires out. But he took money away from a lot of the programs that are in place.
And yeah, but it's
almost comical. It's like the guy doesn't have a grasp of reality.
But he doesn't need to create jobs. He's the more jobs governor, didn't you know?
Yeah. We're 47th in job creation.
Well, we're more than three.
Yeah.
That's something, right?
Follow the money.
Well, I mean, at the end of it, you know, I look at this. My question is if the Marcellus Shale, if the drilling is creating so many jobs, where are they? If all of these handouts that we're giving to corporations are creating jobs, where are they?
Exactly. And he's bringing out-of-state people in to drill for what he's doing right now.
I mean, even that. I mean, those are still counted as jobs, but we're still 47th, Pat. I mean,
exactly.
When you look at this, you talk about all the money that we've given away. And, you know, again, this budget prioritizes more tax breaks for corporations, more allowing the loophole to happen, more not taxing the drillers. If that's the case, if the conservative ideology is correct, that if we lower taxes to where they're non-existent, we deregulate, we go, here, take the baby and the bathwater, if we give it to them, they will come, where are they?
And nothing's come to fruition that he's proposed, from DPW to the oil drillers. But it's a crime, actually, when you figure he's giving away natural resources. Historically, when you look back at the oil boom, if they had done that, we wouldn't be in the great position we are as the great state of Pennsylvania. But this guy, it doesn't register on his map.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who the advisors are or, you know, what payroll he's on, but it's not on the payroll of we the people.
No, and that's why I say no matter who wins next time, I hope that they surround themselves with much better quality people that respond to people's questions and needs and have a thought process that functions.
Yeah, well, and has a vision for the future. I mean, to me, I've yet to see anything come out of this governor that goes, there's a future at stake, that there's a mind for tomorrow other than the $1.7 billion they gave to Royal Dutch Shell over the next quarter of a century.
He has a mind as a prosecutor, and he's out of his realm. He's not a leader. He's not an administrator.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how to lead. He knows how to prosecute people. He didn't do a good job with that with Sandusky and Penn State. That's all for another day. But what were people thinking when they voted for him is what I keep scratching my head and asking myself.
That's a good question. I mean, when you think about it in that frame, that he's got the mind of a prosecutor, that really kind of brings it back. That's not really something that you're looking down the road. You're not visionary. You're just dealing with what's right directly in front of you, what's on the tip of your nose. So, you know, I'm not surprising because, you know,
and I go back to Rendell, Ridge, even Thornburg. They had a business sense, and they had people with them who were bankers and good business people. This guy has none of that. He has he cut himself out, or he says he's cut himself out of budget constraints. He can thank Obama for bringing things back economically to a point, but he has done nothing as far as restructuring or generating any new forms of income. He's turned away opportunities, like with the oil and gas people, that could have put us on good footing, but he doesn't understand that. He doesn't realize what that could do, I guess.
That's an interesting way of putting it, because, you know, what I'm hoping the next governor in the next governor, whoever it is, comes in and says, you know what, we've for too long neglected the future. We've neglected our education system. We've neglected our infrastructure. Even the bill that you guys got passed before last year, this idea that, you know, we're going to invest, I think it was like $2.5 billion.
The transportation bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, that also should have been done, though. That could have been distributed fairly, and he would have had unanimous support. But he had to have a win, so he steamrolled that thing through. And that's, again, the brunt of that's being borne by the people who are the working people who have to commute to work. And it just wasn't the right thing to do either.
No, I mean, it was far too small, even smaller than his own commission.
Right.
Had said that it needed to be.
We had the right plan in place. About 6 years ago, where we told 80 and we did some other things, let the people who were using the system pay for it. But the way this was done, this was all just ram it through and see what happens. Nobody even knows. Nobody knows the funding formula and what money is going to go to what area.
So what I'm told, and help me if you think I'm wrong here, that this budget might not, the way it is, without a bunch of fixes and a bunch of things, may be the first that doesn't get passed on time. I've heard some whispers, because that's really the only thing that the guy's got to run on, is, hey, I'm not Rendell. I can work with my own party to get a budget done on time, even if it is horrible.
And last year's budget wasn't on time. We had to come back, if you remember, until
right.
2 weeks later. And all that aside, you could call that a technicality. But what I predict will happen is it'll be last year's budget with some voids filled in here and there. But they'll scramble because it's an election year, and a lot of the right-wingers have to get reelected, and I think that's what they can hang their hat on. Forget about working people and everything else, but they'll do their damnedest to get it passed by midnight of the deadline, and it'll just be a repeat of last year's budget.
Yeah, the thing is there's so many things that we should be doing, Pat. I mean, really, there are so many things that need attention, and I look at what the priorities have been thus far. And they've been everything, and maybe it's that the Republicans just don't have the answer. Maybe they don't have an idea. Maybe they're fresh out of ideas, and they're just pushing ideology. But I haven't seen anything really come out of the last 3 years that tells me that there was any forethought or thought for tomorrow in that at all.
No, they've got 30 key core group of extreme right-wingers that won't let it go. I had people in my office today in Erie asking about health care bills, simple things that are fixes to local problems, I guess you could call it. But they said, why can't something this simple go through and be solved? And he explained to them how the right-wingers will obstruct anything and how In God We Trust plaques in schools take precedent over mandatory kindergarten funding. People look at you like, what kind of country do you work in? It's almost comical. It's sad, but it's comical.
No, I mean, and you're right. I've seen so many of those things. 2012 was the year of the Bible. We spent time on that.
Yeah.
Look, for someone who does what I do, that's good fodder. Look, if we don't have a transportation bill, it'll bring some prayer back to our lives, and we can pray to get to the other side of the bridge that we don't end up on one that collapses.
Right.
But, you know, at the end of it, it's not really the society that I want as a citizen, as a parent, whose children are going to inherit what we're not doing right now.
And imagine if our grandparents and parents hadn't done the right thing, stepped forward, spent the money. It's disgusting, the fact that these people use the system and now they want to turn their backs on the people that we should be helping out, the next generation to come.
Yeah, let's sell off the lottery. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
So the money that we could have used to help our seniors.
How much money did we waste on that?
Millions.
Yeah,
and
legal fees to attorneys that are friends with Corbett.
And not to mention all of the time, the hearings and all of the legislative time that could have been better spent. Same thing with the privatization of the wine and spirit shops. How many millions of dollars in hearings and votes and all of the stuff that went on to try and privatize this state asset has gone into this?
And they're keeping that going. He mentioned that he even wants to address that.
Last call!
Yeah, he had his people in the back cheering when he mentioned that. It was something to see, because you turned around and they were all executives of companies that would benefit from it.
Yeah, I've yet to find. And look, you know, you talk to a lot of folks on the streets. You know, you're one of those guys who spends a lot of time, and I give you the utmost credit for it. Spends a lot of time talking with constituents. Have you found anyone who says, you know, Pat, I really want to just go to the gas station, pick up my bottle of Jack. I just, you know, I want to go to Walmart or I want to go to the supermarket and get my liquor. That's what I gotta have.
No one ever says a thing about that in my district. It's all they talk about, you know, being able to purchase it cheaper, and we're 20 minutes from the New York state line and the Ohio state line, and we've got the water on the other side. But yeah, those kind of things just aren't registering with people up here. That's you know, the system works. People know where to buy their liquor. They know where to buy their beer. They actually have good rapport with their beer distributors, and they don't want to see them harmed. And when they go to the safe store and they need wine or they need something, they know where to get it, and they know, you know, the hours of the day. And
yep.
I'll bet I've had two people tell me that we should do something with it.
No, I've yet to meet anybody, and I talk to a lot of people. What I have heard a lot of is that, you know, people just want to be able to buy a six-pack.
Yeah.
That's it.
More convenience, modernization, if they want to call it that. But, yeah, for the most part, you know, the system's in place. And then I have to laugh, too, when they say Corbett and his minions tell people we have to sell it because all the other states do it.
Yeah.
And then when I talk to these other people in these other states when we're at conferences and things, they say, hey, we would love to be back in control of this, if for no other reason, for the legal aspect of it, the enforcement aspect.
And when I hear you say that, and I've heard that before, I think, did he not have a mother? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
The first thing my mother told me, if they're going to jump off a bridge, you're going to go with them?
Right.
Evidently, he would.
And again, you go back to a prosecutor. You know, he should be siding with the legal people who tell him state police don't want to have to be monkeying around with this in these rural areas.
Now, and that's the other whole part of it, the societal costs, the cost of enforcement, all of this. That it just is just an amazing cluster. But again, it comes back down to my view that they have nothing better to offer. And to bring up the, you know, the last thing that I did want to bring up, which I think is hugely important. Right now, I understand there's an ALEC piece of legislation that's banging around somewhere in the state government committee that Mad Cow, Daryl Metcalf, wants to bring out. This House Bill 1507, Senate Bill 1034, euphemistically named Paycheck Protection. Have you seen this?
That was the start of Right to Work. A number of Republicans told us, the Sensibles again, told us that the Koch brothers were in town and they were demanding an up or down vote before petitions come out, which is next Tuesday, a week from today. They want to know who their loyal allies are and where they should throw their money in this upcoming election. There was a beautiful rally 2 weeks ago today in Harrisburg, and I think we showed Daryl and some of the others that it's not going to be a cakewalk like they thought with Wisconsin and Ohio and New Hampshire and Indiana and Georgia and some of the others that they're trying to knock off. If you watch, it's methodical where they're doing this at. But I was proud to stand with my fellow union brothers and stick up for the rights of the working person. And after it was over, I think we did show them that, you know, it's not going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah, but I look at this, and first I go, do we have nothing better to do? Or is everything wonderful that we can waste time on this? But just to use the verbiage that they use, paycheck protection, I'm sure you've read it. Anything in there that actually protects someone's paycheck from, oh, I don't know, wage theft or hour theft or any of the other abuses that go on? Is there any real protection? Or is this just another one of those euphemistically named pieces of legislation to get us think, oh, that's so nice?
Yeah, it's just like Right to Work. It's their fragrance sales pitch, we call it. They come up with these gimmicks to think that they catch people and sell it to them and that's going to work on it. But once you explain it to people, they're outraged with them, and I think that's what's going to be the pushback, and hopefully people remember it this coming fall with the election. But, there was no sentiment after that day when they were there. When I talked to some of the Republicans, there was no love for any of the folks that were pushing 1507, and there were 50 co-sponsors, but they were all pretty quiet after that day. And, it did my heart good to see the busloads of people that came in. I would guess there were 6,000 or 7,000 people there.
There were a lot of folks there. But the thing is, look, I think most people, and you hit on this, I think most people are in favor of us having a right to work. Just like the old days where labor said every person should have a right to work, which meant a right to a job, a right to be able to support your family, put food on the table, roof over the head, clothes on the back, all of that stuff. But they've taken it and they've twisted it to where there are no rights and there's no work. Same thing with paycheck protection. Nobody is against protecting my paycheck, making sure that I'm being paid what I should be being paid, that I'm not being cheated out of wages or hours or any of that stuff. But these aren't what these laws are. They're just they just have nice names with none of the things that we think behind them.
Well, they give out, they forget the most important ingredient. Give people the opportunity to work. Get some of their bankers to free up some of the money.
There you go.
Pay TARP and all these other things. And let's get people back to work. And if we're going to cut out the ability to take out union dues, let's cut out the ability to take United Way and everything else out, too. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just dumb because you're taking the state's ability to negotiate for something. Because, look, the workers gave up something for that to happen. I mean, you're taking
right.
a negotiating tool off the table, which, again, you would think people who are pro-business, like they say they are, would understand that, which tells me that they're not pro-business. They don't know anything about business or negotiating. They're just ideologues.
And they needed an ability, like I said. They needed an ability to start right to work, and they needed an ability to show the Koch brothers who their loyal friends were,
yeah.
And this 1507 was going to be the segue for that.
Is this going to get out of the state government committee?
I don't think it will now, and there again, there's a technicality that should not be allowed, but they control the game, so that should be run out of the labor committee, which I'm on. But no, they can't get the sensible people on the labor committee to take it up, so they're running it through state government, where, surprise, Daryl Metcalf is the sponsor of the bill.
Yeah, I mean, because I was going to ask you about that. Shouldn't it be, since it is a labor-based issue, shouldn't it be in the labor committee? And wouldn't the chairman there, I mean, I got to be honest, if I'm the chairman of the labor committee, I'm raising Cain because that's my territory.
Yeah.
You don't water my turf.
And that's why I say you have the dissension within the ranks and these 30, and I don't know how they got 50 co-sponsors, but I know many of the people who were forced to sign on were not real happy about it.
Yeah, and I like the way you put that, forced, because the Koch money was here. And look, you know, I've been getting these rate requests for advertising from these purchasing agents who are saying there's a huge amount of money coming to Pennsylvania here in the next month.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be hammered and inundated with ad after ad after ad from these Washington-based right-wing things.
process that Darwin argued had to be left alone, laissez-faire. That's the philosophy of free enterprise. That's what I call the bastardization of Charles Darwin. Because Charles Darwin himself argued that this was ridiculous to take his findings and apply them totally outside the realm in which the research suggested that they naturally existed. That's the beginning. But there's more. We have passed the top of our first hour together. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Let's pause and take a 4 or 5 minute break. We'll be right back for our second hour here at the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Thank you for being with us. I hope you'll stay with us for our second hour. We'll be right back.
We now return to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility with your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome to today's edition of the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. It is a Monday afternoon. It is 9 minutes after the hour of five here in the East. We welcome you to today's program if you're just joining us. If you've been with us through the first hour, then we especially thank you for staying with us. We've been kind of looking at some of the late 19th century origins, if you will, of a value system, of an anti-regulatory value system. I think an awful lot becomes very clear during this period of American history. It's one of the least studied and yet most important periods in history courses, I believe. Traditionally, most history courses end the Civil War, do something with Reconstruction. It's almost obligatory that you do. Talk about the benefits of the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of the United States as a world power in the 20th century, and then immediately begin to lay the groundwork for World War I. And the period in between there, as to what's going on with the Industrial Revolution, has pretty much been ignored in many of our textbooks throughout our history. I think that's a mistake. And I think what we're seeing right now is behavior and attitudes towards government and towards government regulation that owe their origins to this period. Our phone number, we would love to hear from you. Our phone number, area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. My email address, if you'd like to communicate your thoughts and your ideas on some of these things directly to me independently, then individually, by all means, my email address, waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906@gmail.com. We were talking about social Darwinism, which is the transfer of Darwin's research into the realm of human societies, which Darwin himself referred to as poppycock, could not be done. But obviously, those with an agenda had a very, very clear, real reason to do this. It was the best argument you could possibly come up with against demands for government interference and government regulation. Even more so was it a strong position or a strong foundation for the position against government ownership of the means of production and distribution, i.e. Marxism, socialism, communism. In other words, if you could lay this kind of a value of an environment, of a value system, and at the same time take the most dreaded outcome, which would be government ownership of the means of production and distribution, which Marx advocated in the Communist Manifesto and in Das Kapital, if you could argue against that, then what you were doing was creating the best defense possible for a public opinion that would be wedded to free enterprise, unregulated free enterprise capitalism, and would look askance at any proposal which even smacked of government ownership. And of course, what we end up with in our society is the idea that, to be realistic about it, government regulation can be viewed as a conservative alternative to government ownership. In other words, the best way to demand to counter demand for socialism is with an active regulatory government. I would suggest to you this becomes the operative definition of liberalism, of progressivism. Whereas progressives at the turn of the century, in the early 20th century, have been traditionally viewed as radicals. The fact of the matter is, the progressive movement is led by and defined by middle-class interests in America, who have a vested interest in perpetuating the kind of society we have in America. And the best way to counter demands for socialism, for government ownership of the means of production and distribution, is for an active regulatory government that will make it unnecessary for people to go all the way to something called communism. Theodore Roosevelt referred to this as not radicalism, but the shrewdest form of conservatism. Yet, to be very honest with you, he's dealing with some pretty hard-headed people. Most corporate interests find Roosevelt very, very dangerous and very, very threatening, especially the power he wields in the office of the presidency. And so naturally, the more effective corporate America could be in linking regulation with socialism, with linking big government with socialism, rather than looking at it as a way to prevent socialism, that would be the road that corporate America would most like to travel. The reason I mention this is because that's what we're seeing with the attacks from the right on President Obama. It is absolutely ludicrous to anybody who knows anything about socialism to suggest that a president who is willing to take billions of dollars of public tax money and use it to bail out banks and large corporations, to label that socialism is beyond bizarre. It must be explained only because those who do it believe that they can get away with it, believe that the American public is gullible enough to buy that. I would suggest to you that what Professor McGinley was saying on the LawWorks program on West Virginia Public Television last Thursday evening was just that. The general population of West Virginia has looked at government regulation, at big government, as a more active, intrusive EPA, as a direct threat to West Virginians' motto, Montani Semper Liberi, mountaineers are always free. I would suggest to you that freedom from a regulatory Washington does not necessarily mean freedom. It means freedom for the corporate interests in West Virginia. It does not mean freedom for the working people of West Virginia. And I think that's a particular issue that we need to focus on. One of the things that makes the Industrial Revolution so very successful and explosive in late 19th century America is the application of science to the nation's challenges, to the nation's economy. The application of electricity, for example, to transportation and communication, and the revolution that produces. electricity makes it possible for manufacturing to occur in places other than on major rivers, because no longer does industry need water power in order to generate electricity. That kind of the application of science and the application of new discoveries, the application of technology to the industrial process, is in large part what makes the Industrial Revolution as revolutionary as it in effect becomes. Many people tend to associate the application of Darwin's scientific research to the Industrial Revolution as yet another example of that. And I would suggest to you, in this case, it's not the application of science. It's the manipulation of science in order to support a political agenda. And so we have to be very, very careful as to what constitutes science and what constitutes a bastardization of science, the manipulation of science, the inaccurate manipulation of science. One of the things that has amazed me over the years in education is that during this period is born a phenomenon that we call the social sciences. Everybody who's ever gone to college has at least in one point or another run into the term the social sciences. And as we as college students have been advised in our curriculum, as advisors have told us which courses we want to take depending on what our major course of study is going to be. Colleges and universities have developed what they call a support program of what is usually referred to as general education, general studies. And usually, general studies requirements, regardless of major, have included a certain number of the so-called social sciences. I know in the college that I was affiliated with for more than 20 years, in advising students, I had to be very, very careful to make sure that all students, irrespective of what they were going to end up majoring in, whether they were going to be business majors or accountants, whether they were going to be chemists or biologists, whether they were going to be major in English, history, government, or whatever, all students had to meet certain requirements in what were called the social sciences and the humanities. That's part of what we called and bragged about a liberal education. A liberal arts education, a broad-based education, was one that had to include a certain number of classes, courses, in the humanities and the social sciences. Generally, the humanities were literature, languages, philosophy. Those would be the humanities, the arts, music, theater. So, for example, in our particular situation, every student who graduated from Concord University had to have at least two courses in the humanities. And their choices were history of art, history of music, or history of theater, in addition to required courses in English and in literature. We wanted our graduates to be well-founded in the liberal arts. So we required that of the three classes I named, music, art, or theater. Every student had to graduate with at least two of those three disciplines, had to take two of those three classes as part of their general studies. Because we wanted all of our graduates, whatever their major, to be conversant and familiar with the arts and with music and with theater. Also, all of our graduates had to take at least four social science classes. And the social science disciplines were identified. Students had a choice. They weren't required to take certain social science classes, but they had to take at least four, and they had to mix them up. In other words, all four classes couldn't be in the same discipline. You couldn't take all four classes in economics, or all four classes in history, or all four classes in sociology, or all four classes in psychology. So the social science disciplines were psychology, sociology, history, government, political science, economics, geography. Students were required to take at least four courses, identified courses in those disciplines. And we had certain courses, certain geography classes, certain political science classes, certain history classes, certain sociology classes, and certain psychology classes that carried the label general studies. And students had to take four of those courses in at least three different disciplines. In other words, they couldn't load up in any one subject. They could take a two-semester history class, for example, but they couldn't take any more history. They had to take psychology or sociology or economics or something like that. Business majors, intended business majors, had to make one of their social science choices, economics. Economics was a required two-semester economics course. Was a required class for all business majors. It was an elective for everybody else. And most people never think about this, but it is during this period of late 19th century that the idea of social sciences emerges. For a second, I would ask you to reflect upon the very term social science. The implication is that the studies of these areas related to society itself are sciences. The study of politics, of government, is a science. The study of society itself is a science. The study of human behavior, psychology, is a science. The study of the economic system is a science. The study of geography is a science. The study of the nation's history or the history of the West is a science. The implications of that, I think, are very, very incredible, very informative and incredible as well. Because of all of those disciplines, psychology, sociology, economics, political science, geography, history, there's only one history which is sometimes not included within the social sciences at all, but instead is listed as a humanities class. History is the one that doesn't quite fit all of those others. And for the longest time, I couldn't figure out why. Until several years ago, I began to attend meetings of an organization called the National Association of Scholars. And I began to appreciate the value of scholars from a number of different disciplines coming together to deliver papers, professional papers, and to conduct discussions in the value of research and scholarship, in the value of the pursuit of knowledge. But quickly, I began to realize that of all of those disciplines that we call social sciences, history is the only one that really does involve the pursuit of knowledge. All the rest of the social sciences presume that truth is already known. Political science is the study of representative government. It is based on the assumption that representative government, the government that we have, Republican government, government which includes the term republicanism and democracy, these are the true political sciences. In other words, what political science study are the intricacies of this form of government. But is based on government is the only form that works. Consequently, the rich tends to be skewed by this major assumption. Economics is a social science, the science of capitalism. Again, driven by the assumption that capitalism is the best, therefore the only legitimate economic system, the only way for society to organize itself for the benefit of its people is this way. I am not saying that that's not true. I am saying that the study of economics is based on that assumption. That question is never asked. Economists spend their time focusing on the intricacies of the operation, the functioning of free enterprise capitalism as an economic system. But their research never goes into the areas of whether, in fact, this is the best or indeed the only system that benefits mankind. That is assumed to be true. Psychology, as a social science, the idea that human behavior can be scientifically studied, scientifically researched, and scientifically mastered. The school of psychology that becomes all-powerful and all-popular in the late 19th century is what we call behavioral psychology. Behavioral psychology is driven by very famous research projects. The one I'm thinking of is the one by the Russian psychologist Pavlov, and the research that is usually identified as Pavlov's dogs. Everyone who's ever taken introductory psychology in college has been exposed to Pavlov's research. If you take two dogs in a cage and you feed these dogs and then on a regular basis, and then you suddenly withhold food until the dog performs a required behavioral trick. So, for example, if you present the food but don't give the dog the food, the dog will salivate. Then if you add the ringing of a bell, in other words, as you present the food to the dog and the dog begins to salivate, you ring a bell and then you give the dog the food. If you do that often enough and long enough, the dog will begin to salivate at the sound of the bell, whether in fact there is food there or not. In other words, you can control the dog and make the dog salivate with the ringing of a bell. What we are talking about here is the relationship between a desired response and an appropriate stimulus. And what psychologists are researching in the late 19th century is the effectiveness of stimulus response as a way to predict and ultimately control human behavior. Naturally, behavioral psychology becomes the key ingredient of most teacher preparation programs in colleges and universities. Because what better tool to put in the hands of skilled teachers than the ability to manipulate students into learning what you want them to learn, even if they have no interest in learning it at all, by providing the appropriate stimulus. If students know that there's a reward at the end, they will perform accordingly. If animals learn that there's a reward at the end, they will respond accordingly. Thus, in the late 19th century, for all practical purposes, we have scientifically demonstrated the value of teaching built around the stimulus-response model. Psychology has become a science. And it is one of the more popular sciences. And there's a whole magazine that comes out every month called Psychology Today, in which you can read about the latest research projects, which tend to reinforce the idea that human behavior can be predicted, can be defined, and can be controlled. It's a science. Think about the problems that the United States of America is facing in the late 19th century as a result, literally, of the overnight explosion of America's largest industrial cities, populated by people from all over the world, who come to the city in pursuit of jobs. People of different religions, people of different nationalities, people that speak different languages, people that come from totally different ethnic backgrounds, people whose hair colors are different, people whose eye coloring is different, people whose language is different, people whose religions are different, people whose color is different. All of them living within the confines of overcrowded, unhealthy cities unable to develop fast enough appropriate residences to accommodate human beings, to develop adequate sewer systems, to generate the kind of food that is necessary to feed exploding populations, to deal with the expansion and growth of crime and disease and overcrowding in unhealthy living conditions. People who are working in unregulated factory and industrial conditions, an inordinate number of hours, with insufficient breaks, at inadequate pay that is oftentimes reduced depending on the needs and priorities of the employer. And these people are screaming for relief, are screaming for help, and they naturally look to government to get it. A government that is operating under the philosophies best defined in the world of nature by Charles Darwin. A corporate environment that is being defined by the philosophy of laissez-faire, which is being reinforced with the scientific findings of one Charles Darwin, which argues against government relief for the poor, argues against the interference with the natural laws of the market, the natural laws of supply and demand. Let the market define need. Don't interfere, because in doing that, potentially you are keeping the unfit alive and you are jeopardizing the very progress of society itself. And we have all sorts of scientific evidence to prove this. We have the research findings of our sociologists, which suggest the best way to keep an increasingly diverse population that is exploding in America's cities peaceful and able to coexist and live together is to integrate the schools, is to require mandatory education of all people, and force the schools to integrate different nationalities, different religions, different races, to create what in the 19th century sociologists began to refer to affectionately as a melting pot. America's cities become a melting pot. America becomes a melting pot. And out of the mix of nationalities, out of the mix of races, out of the mix of a variety of different ethnic groups, out of the mix of a variety of languages, you put it all into this pot and you stir it up, and out comes something called an American. A person who has been indoctrinated into an appropriate value system to support the free enterprise economic system that is underway. A system which becomes difficult to challenge because scientists, a particular group of scientists that we have come to call economists, are bringing chapter and verse in research to prove beyond a doubt that this is the best economic system for mankind. This offers the most, the very best. And you question, people begin to question the unfairness of government and government favoritism towards corporations, government's willingness to respond to big money, and consequently they begin to challenge these illicit political relationships. And in response to those challenges comes the research of political scientists who make recommendations as to how best to tweak the system in order to make sure that the political system which best supports this economic system will work the way it should work. And then you turn to solving the problems of America's cities and the urban sprawl and the diversity that exists within urban America and the crime and the hostility and the potential violence that is building up within America's cities. And you turn to the appropriate scientists to solve that. In this case, we call these scientists sociologists. And the sociologists begin to do the kind of research that empowers them to make the recommendations on how best to manage and organize America's cities in such a way that you make human accommodation to the realities of industrial America possible. And then you bring in another group of scientists called psychologists, and they begin to share with us the kind of research which shows the most appropriate stimulus response mechanism that is necessary to solve the problems of urban industrial America. And the implication is that all of these different brands of science become the agencies of government. And government moves in the public interest to apply the various and sundry applications of scientific research to the problems of urban and industrial America. And as long as we call it science, it's very difficult to refute. The only one of those social sciences that is different is history. And the reason for that is that historical research, true historical research, involves the pursuit of truth. Every other one of those disciplines is based on the assumption that truth is already known. We already know the proper economic system. We already know the proper proper political system. We already know the proper mechanism to resolve the problems of a diverse society. It's called the melting pot. It's called integration. It's called turning our schools from vehicles that educate youngsters into institutions that indoctrinate them. The major educational reform of this period is the introduction of the American high school. The requirement, not just that kids go to school for a minimum number of years in order to learn the appropriate value system, but the idea that the only way that society can protect itself is to require that students go to school for a long time, until they reach the age of 16 years old, until they complete high school or turn 16, whichever becomes first. These become state requirements, but they are state-driven reforms that serve a national purpose, which is to keep kids in school long enough to indoctrinate them and hopefully to teach them the minimal skills that they will need in order to get a job in industrial America. The operative assumption being that very few of these people are going to be going to Harvard or Stanford or the University of Chicago or anywhere else. Of course, we do have Jefferson's model of periodic skimmings of the cream of ability to identify the talent and scholarship those students. But the general operative assumption is the vast majority of immigrants coming into this country are coming in to get jobs to work in the factories. Our entire education system models itself on supporting this economic reality. Our students go to school during the regular school day, and they are learned to respond to bells. Periods begin with a bell. Periods end with a bell. Students are lined up in rows. Students are marched from one class to the other class. The model of the military, the model of basic training, becomes the model of education in our nation, the majority of our nation's public schools. Because only military discipline will control the uncontrollable until the value system takes. That requires more years than Jefferson's three. It requires more years than just completion of elementary school. It requires more years than junior high school. It requires the age of 16. 12 years of mandatory public education in which parents are encouraged to turn their children over to the state, with the idea that at the end of it, there will be a job. And we will have an educated citizenry, educated well enough to perform the job that is being defined by industrialism. I would suggest to you it was fine for the late 19th and early 20th century. In the 21st century, it can't work anymore. It can't work anymore. It is killing us. Schools are modeled on the nine-month school year built around agriculture, built around the fact that many of these people grew up in rural America and now are matriculating, are moving into the cities in order to get jobs. And we have all of these immigrants, 5 million immigrants in the year 1905 alone, come into the United States. What is America to do with this kind of a population other than to retool it into something very unique called the American? And what defines that American is not color. It is not accent. It is not language. It is not religion. It is not nation of ethnic origin. It is values. It is the values which have been defined and developed in order to support the system of free enterprise capitalism which has been developed and is currently underway. It is a value system which helps explain very well the political system which functions hand in hand with that economic system. A value system based on the idea of republican government, of participatory government, where everybody participates in making the rules and making the laws under which they live. But a degree of participation which is clearly defined. I would suggest to you that in America, as we enter the 20th century, the definition of the term democracy is increasingly defined as being able to participate in the political process. The founders knew, Madison knew what democracy was. Democracy was majority rule. But the definition of democracy that emerges in America at the beginning of the 20th century is participatory democracy, the right to participate in making the rules by electing the people who make the decisions. I would suggest to you that that is not the definition of democracy that James Madison used. James Madison was afraid of the majority faction because he was afraid of majority democracy. The definition of democracy that we have adopted is one that works very well in this political, economic, social system that we call the modern United States of America. It is a system which supports a nation which, in a matter, history's terms, relatively overnight, has moved from a relatively insignificant nation in a world of nations to one of the major, most dominant political powers, industrial powers in the world. It is a major competitor as being the dominant industrial power. World War I in Europe eliminates the competition. It destroys Europe and leaves the United States as the major industrial power in the world. Consequently, the United States dominates the 20th century world. Its people are raised in a value system based on the idea that they were born and bred to dominate the world. Because of technology, because of the internet, no longer is the United States of America dominating anything. And we have instead developed a value system to support a world that no longer exists. More and more evidence, in quotes, scientific evidence, to prove that we are right. And once you are sure you are right, then there's nothing wrong with defining everything else as being an untruth, as being a threat. Consequently, there's nothing wrong with keeping foreign ideas and foreign books out of the hands of American youth. If you protect and control what information gets into the hands of our young people, then you don't need to teach them the skills that they would need in order to understand and to know. You are basically riding herd over exactly what it is they must know, they should know. And to accept that as truth because you say it is. We had better get about our business. I think a good start is here at the Head On Radio Network, and hopefully here at the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. It is 58 minutes after the hour. Bob Kincaid is chomping at the bit to visit with you and tell us all about his weekend. I want to thank you for being with us today. I want to tell you how much I have enjoyed being back here at the Virtual Center with you. Please be safe. We want you back. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good evening.
Don't you
stop America!
I'll play you
proud,
Germany! go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Evening, afternoon, morning, night, howdy, as noted. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find entree to the chat room, as well as to the Listen Live button. But if you're already listening, if you need to tell your friends or something. Listen Live button at the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chat room. And also, of course, the Listen... and Listen Live, and it's also available on TuneIn and Stitcher Internet Radio. Podcasting available at iTunes, and the podcast address is under the subdomain for this program at whiterosesociety.org. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Back from an epic journey. Actually, it wasn't epic so much as it was... Whirlwind covers it quite nicely, really. And I had a magnificent trip to New York City. And I can now say that I understand a little bit of what all the hoopla is about. What a town. Got there about 7:30 Saturday evening. I was met by Pterodactyl from Republican30Tricks.com, who I was at Midtown, so she and I walked down, saw Times Square, went over, had a bite to eat at Grand Central Station. I love Grand Central Station. I love train stations in general because there's just something inspiring about them, and there's not much more inspiring than Grand Central Station. And we were talking while I was there about the fact that, this, can you imagine something like Grand Central Station being built in this day and age of Republicans who holler, "We can't do that! We're poor!" Or if a company decided to build it, they'd want an entire tax giveaway for the rest of their immortal corporate lives, right? It was a wonderful trip. I learned a lot. I saw a lot. Had actual, authentic, no kidding, lox and bagels for breakfast on Sunday morning before heading over to the MSNBC studios at 30 Rockefeller Center. I was just a half a block down Broadway from the Ed Sullivan Theater, where they had replicated the 50 years ago today, not today, but yeah, the marquee for the Ed Sullivan Show featuring the Beatles. It was just neat. All the way around, it was neat. I saw some examples running contrary to most of the stereotypes about New York. And it was a reminder that it's not just, it's not just hillbillies that get stereotyped. This place where I live is no closer to being the, and let's remember, it was, after all, in Arkansas where the Beverly Hillbillies were from. This is no more Hooterville or Bug Tussle than, or Siler's Swamp than New York City is the New York City of of television. But that's how we all learn about, I guess, except by traveling, how we learn about the rest of the country. And one of the things that I found surprising was that without fail, well, out here in the hinterlands, we're told that New Yorkers are a grim and taciturn bunch who never speak on the streets, who don't make eye contact with one another, blah, 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 blah. Nothing could be further from the truth, at least as I experienced it in a very, very short period of time. One particular instance really grabbed me. The hotel was on West 55th Street. And I just decided to walk around the corner to Broadway, walked around the other corner to whichever street that was. And on the way back, a man with long, shaggy, white hair and an elder and a couple of bags of his belongings had laid down in the doorway of a renovating restaurant or something and covered himself on a brutal night. It was probably 12 degrees at the moment. Had covered himself up with an overcoat. And a guy with an obvious New York accent was standing there remonstrating with him. You know, he wasn't yelling at him. He wasn't telling him, "You all right, Pops? You okay? Pops, it's awful cold here. I don't think I'd be trying to get, you know, maybe you might want to find a mission." But he wasn't giving him hell. He was caring about it. And instead of laying there, and the old gentleman sat up and was talking with the other guy and becoming more and more alert. And I just sat there and watched a stereotype die. You know, the uncaring New Yorker. And everywhere we went, people were talking to each other. "Hey, how you doing?" "Yeah, good. You?" All of that. And just little moments like that are worth paying attention to. It was a heck of a trip all the way. I got in the plane. Thank you, George Carlin. You get on the plane. I'll get in the plane. I got in the plane in Charleston, the little Air Keebler, Canadair Regional Jet Bombardier CJ-200, I believe. I just call it Air Keebler, by elves, for elves. And was cheek to jowl and shoulder to shoulder with a fella roughly my same size. The jet was full plumb to bursting. And one row back sat our drunk. And I'd no sooner sat that, well, I smelled him before I saw him. This is not any kind of indictment of drinking or anything like that, but the guy was hammered at 12:30 in the afternoon. Maybe some people need to do that in order to be, maybe they're fear of flying or what. So we get, it's about a 50-minute flight from Charleston, West Virginia, 336 air miles to Atlanta, Georgia. And as soon as the flight attendant came through, I said, "I'll take a tomato juice." And the guy said, I'll have a seven and seven. Well, no, and it was all carried on very sotto voce. "Well, no, sir, I don't think I have that." "All right, then I'll take a CC and Coke." And he was determined. "No, I don't think I can serve you, sir. You're intoxicated." "Well, I've never heard of such a thing." And so we were off and running. And when we got out of the plane in Atlanta, he got off the plane, and "I want your name and identification number. I've never been refused liquor on a flight in my life." And you're just sitting there in the plane going, please, no scenes, no scenes, no scenes. And nobody came and arrested him or carried him away or anything, but he was muttering all the way up the jetway exit ramp, calling her everything under the sun. Oh, dear. But after that, it was actually a nice, the rest of the flight was fine, smooth. Had a wonderful smooth flight into New York from Atlanta. And got a nice evening city lighting up view. It was beautiful. It really is. And I was just as excited as I could be. And at least I can say that I still have that sense of wonder going for me. And it turned out the hotel that I was in had, I was on the 12th floor, and the 14th floor was apparently a very popular dance club. Something that once upon a time would have been referred to perhaps as a disco. And after we had walked around and I'd seen a few sights, came back and thought about maybe just going up to check out the local scene, but then thought, no. Let us sit here, do our homework, let me do my reading, make sure I've got everything squared away. Because in many ways, whether it's a 7-minute segment on a TV program or a 3-hour program like this, the only way to be prepared is to try to read everything under the sun. And so I did, and I did learn, in fact, that New York is the city that never sleeps, because I was treated to the reverberations of 138 beats per minute, broadcasting downward from two floors above. I can only imagine how much fun it was for folks on the 13th floor. Then again, maybe it didn't have a 13th floor. Maybe I was right underneath them. But it was a wonderful time. Like I said, got up the next morning. Had lox and bagels for breakfast because, you know, I had to. I mean, there's some things you have to do. And then away we went to the studios. And it was just a magnificent experience. And Melissa Harris Perry is a very genial person, both on camera and off. And we had some very nice, in-depth conversations off camera about more of the stuff that's going on here. By now, I presume most of you have seen the video of the segment. And I appreciate the kind words that many of you have offered in the wake of that moment. Got to go into makeup, got my face powdered and stuff, and resisted the urge to say, I'm ready for my close-up, Max. Their faces. But it was a magnificent experience. And I'm thrilled to pieces to be home. Got home about 11:40 last night. Plane left LaGuardia with me in it at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Then there was about an hour turnaround for the ride home from Atlanta to Charleston. And then, went up. And the fun part was the last 10 miles of the trip were a drive that was taken on a road in which you could not see either side of the road or any lines thereon. It was just a solid field of white. Oh, joy. So that was taken at lower than usual speeds up the mountain. In the interim, though, and this is one of the more interesting parts of the travel process, the ride home, Delta has started sending us one Airbus A320 per day in and out of Charleston. So the last ride home was on that Airbus A320, which beats the dickens out of that Air Keebler CRJ200. And it's, you know, it has a significantly greater capacity than does the CRJ200. Whole bunch of hillbillies going home, including a group of fundamentalists who were returning home from taking Christianity to the heathens in Costa Rica. Yeah. But regardless of that, I just started talking with some of my neighbors there as we were waiting to board the plane in Atlanta, talking about this whole ongoing water disaster. And something fascinating began to happen. Because it became obvious rather quickly that people are, and I want to make sure I get the right word here, pissed off. Significantly, seriously pissed off. Do you all remember the clip when this thing was unfolding of that guy named Gary Southern with the sort of indeterminate English / Scots accent holding his bottle of water and talking about how he had a really long day, and the one gutsy young reporter from the TV station, when he tries to walk away, says, no, stop. We're not done. You've got more questions to answer. A lot of us have had long days. A lot of us haven't had showers. Well, it turns out that that young woman was something like 7.5 months pregnant at the time she was asking those questions. And that certainly puts a lot of context around maybe what was going through her mind in the moment. Because who knows, maybe she had given her baby an in utero drink of crude chlorhexane methanol that day, or maybe several. Because remember please, there were at least 8 hours, and more it seems obvious that there were more than 8 hours of this stuff going into the water supply and nothing being done about it. While one individual and I were talking, another fellow came up and said, not trying to listen in on your conversation, but I gotta tell you something. And I said, yeah, sure. And he said, I've been working in the industry and delivering things up to coal prep plants for 20 years. And he said, I've seen that stuff all over the place. I've seen it on the ground. At no point in time in my entire career has anybody ever bothered to tell me it was dangerous. I said, how do you feel about that? He said, I'm scared to death. And you could see in his eyes and hear in his voice the genuineness of his concern. I said, then why don't you tell your story? He said, because I'll be blackballed. And then I'll never be able to get work in West Virginia again. And I'll have to move somewhere else, move away from the land that my family's lived on for 200 years. And it's true. It's absolutely true. That's how this place gets to be this place. The brutal, brutal, unregulated manipulation of the people by companies and corporations that are obsessed only with their own profits. And that's what we're up against here. People are scared to speak out. Nonetheless, many are beginning to speak out. Not the least of whom is Jay Rockefeller. Gave a fascinating little interview to one of the TV stations here. In it, he said, and he was asked by WCHS TV 8 out of Charleston whether he would drink the water and whether he thought it was safe. And in regard to the question about the safety of the water, he said, "No, I don't. Even if some expert group told me it was safe, I don't think I'd believe it. They can say it's not hazardous or this or that, but it doesn't mean anything. If people can't drink the water, they can't live. Everything else in the economic, social, and personal life of West Virginia just disappears if you can't drink water." "I know," he said, "there are people in West Virginia who have told my office or me that they're thinking of leaving. They're mostly people with very young babies. They look to a future of this kind of lack of regulatory control and discipline, and they say, where I live is less important than my children growing up healthy." It just gets into the degree of control that corporations have over people. They dominate in West Virginia's life. Governors get elected, and I was a governor once, he said, and they appoint people to regulatory jobs who help them in campaigns. What does that tell you? Of the lack of inspection of the tank farm where Freedom Industries started this whole disaster. And he said, "It may not be a criminal act, but it ought to be, in this case, on the part of the state or federal government, and certainly on the part of the company." Notice how the company came last. What's really fascinating is if you go to WCHSTV.com and go to their raw news section and watch the entire interview, you'll notice that there's a word he never uses. One little word. It's the dirtiest four-letter word in the English language. C. It's the C word. C-O-A-L. He'll talk about how companies and corporations have a stranglehold on the government of this state, but he still will not dare say coal. When I'm pretty sure that the stranglehold that companies have on this state is not from the unicorn sparkle pony fart energy sector. Right? Yeah. But in the course of all these conversations, and especially the gentleman who said he dared not speak up even though he's scared to death that he's probably been poisoned for years on end, lest he be blackballed and never be able to work again. By the way, did you know that's illegal, blackballing? Yeah, it is. They do it anyway. Massey, now Alpha Natural Resources, is, if you interview some former employees, notorious for this kind of conduct. But anyway, it got me to thinking about something that I've experienced a number of times over the years, where you'll reach out and talk to somebody and say it's a business owner, and say, "Look, you got to speak up against what's happening here." I mean, we experienced this trying to do a little work over in the tourism area of Fayette County. You got to speak up, you got to speak out. This is a moral, ethical, and a business issue. And almost without fail, the response you get is, "Yeah, but this is the coal industry we're talking about, and if we speak out, they'll put us out of business." Huh. How about that? A lot of people didn't speak out. A lot of businesses didn't speak out. And they got put out of business anyway. There's a rough estimate that the shutdown of business in the few days after the disaster began to unfold, when everybody was shut down by the health department, that cost economically something on the order, and I would submit that this is a low ball number, because it doesn't take everything into account, something like $61 million. Now, that's not taking into account their plumbing, their water fixtures, their water heater, all the things that work around that, the health care costs of people who may later find out that they've been toxically exposed and have medical problems as a result. None of that's in there. This is just $61 million worth of lost business. They didn't speak out, and the coal industry killed them anyway. Because this is, even though Jay Rockefeller is afraid to say the word coal, and even though Gert, and I know I don't have the time in my life anymore to, every time I want to reference him, say Governor Earl Ray Tomlin. We're just going to call him Gert from now on. Even though Gert ran right out there while he was, before he could, well, this is not a coal problem. There's not a coal mine anywhere near here. That's what Gert said. But the chemical never would have been here if it had not been needed in the coal preparation process. So yeah, it's a coal problem. And we've got this stuff all over southern West Virginia and have no idea what its effects are, what concentrations it's in. Nothing. This problem's not going away. Now the Charleston Tourism People, Convention and Visitors Bureau, I think that's what it's called, is beginning to panic a little bit because, you know, organizations would occasionally book a convention in Charleston. It's not a terrible... Charleston's a cute little riverside city in the mid-Atlantic region. It is reachable from just about everywhere. The hotel rates are not ridiculously expensive. There's some decent restaurants. Okay nightlife. I mean, it ain't New York. But it's okay. And so you'll get the occasional convention. Guess what? That's over. And that is to be expected in boom-bust mono-economies. Eventually, they take out everything. And it's right before they bust and just wipe out what's left. So now they have. The article I read noted that Charleston likes to think that it competes with, and I laughed, frankly. They said, well, we compete for convention dollars with cities like Lexington, Kentucky, and Nashville. And really, I spit-taked on the word Nashville. If there's an organization out there that can't decide between Nashville, Tennessee, and Charleston, West Virginia, I don't know. Maybe it's the Association of Retired Clowns. But there's no comparison. Lexington, Charleston, I can halfway buy that. But whoever Charleston thought it was competing with, it's out of the race, Charleston is. Because who's going to want to come and do a convention in a town where even Jay Rockefeller says he wouldn't trust the experts if they said the water was safe? At the end of the day, one of these days, somebody's going to have to say, listen, we're going to have to replace the whole water system. All at once. Yeah. A couple of more recent developments in the ongoing water disaster. It turns out that the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, according to an article today by Ken Ward over at the Gazette, and what in God's name do we have to do to get this man a Pulitzer? He has uncovered the fact that the U.S. Chemical Safety Board had evaluated the chemical storage tanks at Freedom Industries. And it didn't take the U.S. Chemical Safety Board very long to figure out that the tanks didn't meet industry standards. And that was in October that they reviewed the tank farm. Oh, well. Right? Well, so they didn't actually inspect the tank that had the tens of thousands of gallons of crude methyl chlorohexane methanol in it. But they did, for instance, examine some of the other tanks. There was a field hearing by the House of Delegates Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. And Chemical Safety Board Chairman Rafael Moore Erasso said the tanks in use at Freedom Industries were over one half century old. Considering the best way to improve the safety of tanks at facilities that have similar tanks in use is an important question. They also showed the, we've talked a lot about on this program about how utterly, completely, totally useless the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection is. Well, at this hearing, they showed a blown-up poster of a photograph taken by the WVDEP that showed two little holes in the bottom of the disaster tank of MCHM. Yeah. Let's see, some of the fun facts. Company documents further show that the wall was not lined and that tank 396 rested directly on porous material, including gravel and soil. Oops. The secondary containment wall provided very little protection from a possible release. And of the October 13th evaluation, CSB lead investigator Johnny Banks said of the October 2013 inspection, there was some concern about the condition of the tanks. I imagine. But not enough concern to make GIRT order or pursue a cease and desist or anything like that against his campaign contributors. Rafael Moore Erasso also told the panel, while there are laws prohibiting polluting to waterways with a spill, there are not really any clear mandatory standards for how you site, design, maintain, and inspect non-petroleum tanks at storage facilities. It's good to know, I guess. Mercy. And then there are the ongoing questions of, well, how do we deal with this? And particularly questions of, what about the children? Mackenzie Mays writing at the Charleston Gazette, headline today, no end date set for use of bottled water in schools. In a way, that's a good thing. In another, it's a bad thing. Kids at schools have been drinking bottled water, and school meals have been prepared with bottled water. Sinks and fountains have been off limits. But remember, one school cook she fainted, I think, and they took her to the hospital the other day because she ran the dishwasher, which will never be okay again. Or it is not reasonable nor prudent to think it will be okay again. Liza Cordero is a spokesperson for the West Virginia Department of Education. She said, an end date for bottled water has not been established at the schools. Ultimately, that service is being provided in collaboration with the National Guard. There's an expectation they'll continue to provide it, but a final date is not determined. Is that language a little bothersome to you? It bothers me, but then again, at this point in time, just about every story about this ongoing disaster, it gives me a case of the squirming creepies. An end date for bottled water has not been established. It should not even be considered. But then this line about, ultimately, that service is being provided in collaboration with the National Guard. Does that mean the National Guard has some sort of say-so over this? You see, every aspect of government is failing in this disaster. Because every aspect of government is somehow dependent on people who think that this state exists for the purpose of servicing the coal industry and the oil industry and the gas industry, but mostly the coal industry. Liza Cordero went on and said that it was important that people understand that just because the schools are giving the children bottled water doesn't mean the tap water's unsafe. I refer to you to Senator Jay Rockefeller, Ms. Cordero, who said you couldn't make him drink the tap water. She said, we've received tests back, and even the more stringent and rigorous tests are showing the non-detect level for our schools. However, to bring peace of mind to our parents and to be sensitive to counties, we're continuing to provide that water. See, non-detect does not mean non-present. And nobody can say when or if that non-present level will be reached. One group of disgusted West Virginians has begun mailing bills to West Virginia American Water Company, who have gotten a great big giant pass so far. But they're sending people water bills who have big water bills even though they didn't have big water usage. They wouldn't, oh golly gee, no, they wouldn't try to run a little fast one on the ratepayers, would they? You know, just to make sure that corporate profits keep up with expectations of shareholders? Oh, please, pshaw. Nice note coming in from Kathy out in Arizona. She said, just watch the Melissa Harris-Perry show. Your point about how different the reaction would be if a terrorist had dumped 10,000 gallons in the water supply was great in summing up the entire problem.